this is Feynman had sort of invented some Feynman diagrams when he was kind of your age. That is, he was trying to figure out some way of keeping track of things in quantum mechanics, and he drew these little pictures which described what was going on. And then later on, other people figured out how those little pictures really corresponded in a very, very direct way to what you would do in quantum field theory. Now, Feynman was a bit of a stinker. I think it's fair to say that. My relations with Feynman were all bad. I didn't have much in the way of relations with Feynman. Once upon a time, called him up to tell him with, perhaps I shouldn't have done this, but with great pride that I had proved that something or other that he had done was wrong. Now, I never got to telling him about that, because I said I was working with Green's functions, well, you saw about Green's functions, and he allowed that he'd never heard of Green's functions, and what were Green's functions? I got stuck on that and never told him about anything else. Then I came to Caltech, which is Caltech is where he worked. You've got to understand about Caltech. Caltech is a place with mountaintops. Every professor is the mountaintop. His students, well, his postdocs are here on the towards the top of the mountain, and his students are further down. And well, okay. So every professor is a mountaintop, and they don't much communicate with one another at Caltech, at least didn't in those days. And I came to give a colloquium, and I told them, I'm going to tell you pretty much the same story I'm going to tell in the next 4 days, about what you could and what you couldn't do about with phase transition problems. And I sort of, towards the end, emphasized that the renormalization group techniques weren't good for everything. You couldn't do everything with them. You'd do only some things. And Feynman glommed onto that. That was what he wanted to hear about the lecture. And we talked for the next 15 minutes with Feynman leading the discussion about what you couldn't do with renormalization. Good old Feynman. Gell-Mann, you have to understand, was almost as bright as Feynman. Not quite, but that's a very, very high standard. Gell-Mann was almost as bright as Feynman. But Gell-Mann is a bit colorless. Feynman, as you know, with his bongo drums and believing that he could speak Spanish in Brazil and other exciting things that he did, was a person who was really very, very, very colorful. But Gell-Mann, please don't quote me when you see him, but Gell-Mann, not. And all Gell-Mann's life, he, standing there on his mountaintop, was sort of in the shadow of Feynman. Now, my similes aren't great. Maybe mountaintops don't have shadows. But he was sort of in the shadow of Feynman and didn't feel real good about it. Well, tragically, at the end of, towards the end of Feynman's life, he came down with a cancer. But as Gell-Mann's wife pointed out, Feynman's cancer wasn't your typical cancer that sort of everybody has, I think including her. But in any case, what she pointed out was that Feynman's cancer was like Feynman. He had the only case of his kind in the world. It was exciting and interesting, and all the doctors wanted to know about it. These were very, very exciting people, of course. I didn't know many of the other exciting people sort of from that generation or the earlier generation. I never met Einstein. I saw Fermi lecture once. I met Niels Bohr once, more than once, but I worked at the Bohr Institute in 1960, which was the end of Bohr's life, sort of. He died a few years later. Now, when Bohr got to be famous, the brewery in Denmark, everybody's sort of into culture, including and especially the breweries. The Carlsberg Brewery, many of you know Carlsberg quite well. The Carlsberg Brewery supported the arts mostly, and the Tuborg Brewery mostly supported the sciences. But Carlsberg had one thing that it did in the sciences. It had a mansion on the brewery site, on this place where the brewery was. And that mansion was given to Denmark's most famous artistic figure, or cultural figure, for his or her lifetime. And so Bohr moved into that. And according to the story, now these are stories, and can't vouch for the entire truth of them, the Carlsberg people asked, well, of course you want some beer in your place. How many should we deliver each day? And Bohr thought for a moment and said half a dozen. And the next morning, according to the story, half a dozen cases of beer arrived. Well, when I met Bohr, he was sort of quiet. He was always sort of quiet. One of the things that hampered communication in the Bohr Institute. Bohr spoke softly, and he spoke into himself, and he spoke a language which was a mixture of English and Danish. And furthermore, he had a speech defect, so speaking softly and into himself, really sort of nothing came out. Trying to have a discussion with him then was a difficult endeavor because you sort of couldn't understand what he was saying. But the job was to go along and say things so that you appeared to keep up your side of the conversation. And Bohr would say things, and maybe he was talking about the same subject, and maybe he wasn't. Bob Schrieffer, who was one of the people who discovered the BCS theory of superconductivity, roughly that same time went to visit Bohr and had a more close interaction with him than I had. Bob's story is that he and Bohr were walking together up and down the hall, and Bohr kept asking him, at least according to what Schrieffer understood, so tell me about this, your theory of superconductivity. What is it really deeply about? And then they would walk back a little bit, and then Bohr would come talking about his own subject, which was a little obscure to Schrieffer, so we never found out what the subject was. But Bohr would go on about blah, 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 in his inimitable Danish. And they get to the end, and Bohr would say again, but Schrieffer, tell me about. And then Bohr would continue telling about his own. Okay. I will do one more and then get back to work. In the good old days, well, you have seminars here, not too many, but you do have seminars here. But in the old days, seminars were a little different. A seminar was something that was run by a big shot professor, a mountaintop. Each big shot professor had their own seminar, and they were the star attraction of the seminar. And so, for example, at the University of Chicago, Fermi had a seminar, and Fermi would people would get together, and Fermi would more or less say, you, what are you doing today? Tell us about your research. And you would have to get up and tell them all about your research, prepared or unprepared, good or bad, it didn't matter, you would tell about it. This was sort of better than what happened at the Landau Institute. And the Landau was even more of a dictator than Fermi. And Landau would do exactly what I said. And then you allow people to go for about 60 seconds and say the equivalent in Russian of, this is absolute bullshit. Sit down, I don't want to hear it. Let's see about physics. Instead of running my simulation again, when you got the story, that took a little time. Let me kill off the computer and try to do a little bit of work here. 10 seconds, it's going to go up, it says. Last time we were talking about the virial theorem and about how Clausius and others used the statement that the time that for a system in equilibrium, the time average of the following quantity was equal to zero. This time average then turned out to be the sum over j. If I take the time derivative on pj, I get the energy dqj with a minus sign times qj plus the plus sign. The other one is the energy dpj times pj.
Excuse me? Why
is it zero? Okay. Let me describe what was done last time. He calculated, Clausius did, the time integral from some time zero up to some time t of this time derivative. And he said, if I have a system in equilibrium, then what is obviously going to be true is that the average, no, obviously means it's hard to understand, so I shouldn't use the word obviously. This thing will have the same value at time zero and at time t, so that this time derivative, which is the same at time zero and at time t, now let me get this right, this time derivative, okay, let's call this quantity W, although it isn't exactly the virial.
What is that equality in between?
Okay. You guys don't like my blackboard work for very good reason. So we put a bracket there, and we take this thing away. And we say, this guy is what we might call W, although that isn't exactly historically right. And it is undoubtedly true that this time derivative is equal to that. That's easy. You got me on a bad day. If we take the integral of this, this thing is then going to be the integral of this from 0 to t. No problem with that. Since the system is in equilibrium, the value of anything is going to be the same at initial time and final time. Therefore, the difference between the value of this at an initial time and a final time is going to be equal to zero. Now you got me. I'm worried about something. Namely, so dw dt at time zero is equal to dw dt at time t. And now I'm missing a piece of the argument, which I feel embarrassed about. Excuse me. I want to say that this quantity is zero because, I want to say that this quantity is zero, that is the thing in square brackets, because I know that this quantity, which is then equal to W at T equals zero, at T minus W of zero, that's equal to zero because the system is in equilibrium. Now, this, because the system is in equilibrium, I drew a minus sign, because the system is in equilibrium, this thing is essentially independent of time. If its time integral is going to be equal to zero, then it's going to be true that the quantity itself is going to be, on the average, zero. So the average of this and the average of that add up to zero. I did finally answer your question just by the skin of my teeth. Some days it's harder than other days. So what we have then by this argument is that the sum over j, the epsilon dqj, my d plus sign, the epsilon dqj times qj is equal to the sum over j pj times d epsilon dpj. Now, this is already a very interesting thing from a very modern perspective. Clausius, I don't think, thought about it in this way. But we are interested, we're going to be talking a lot over the next 4 days, about scaling properties. We're going to be talking particularly about things that depend on, for example, Tc minus T to some power called x. And the way you look at this is that you calculate, so let me call this quantity Q. You calculate T times dQ dt. And you discover that this is x times Q. That's what the differentiation gives you. You call this x a critical index, and you're interested in the value of x. The structure, t times the derivative with respect to t, or q times the derivative with respect to q, or p times the derivative with respect to p, picks out the power with which things scale. And then what we're talking about here is the scaling properties of the energy. How does the energy scale? With what power does it go with pj, and what power does it go with qj? At the end of the last hour, I did this term. At the end of the last hour, I said that this was that in the case in which we have epsilon is p squared over 2m plus u, we then have something simple to say about this. This is the sum over all particles of pj dot pj over m, that's the velocity, which is d epsilon dp. Yes. And this is then equal to the sum over j p squared over m. This agrees with this rule. Epsilon has a term in it like p squared. And so what comes out proportional to the thing you started with. It's p squared over 2m, so you should have gotten a factor of 2, but that factor of 2 killed the 2 in the 2m. So this is a result which is not only expected, but obvious. If we had, for example, epsilon is p times c, highly relativistic result, we would get a term that looked like the sum over j of pc. And in fact, Boltzmann himself used this to analyze used something like this to analyze the gas of photons and get the Stefan-Boltzmann law. But that's neither here nor there from the point of view of this argument. We then have to talk about this term and then go on to this term. P squared over 3m, p squared over 2m is 3kt. P squared over 2m is 3 halves kt. P squared over m is 3kt times the number of particles in the system. We know about this because we know about the piece about the equal partition theorem, and we say that any quadratic degree of freedom will give us a 3 halves kt, and p squared over 2m is a quadratic degree of freedom, and there are 3 of them, except that they're n particles, so there are 3n of them, and we know how to get that result. Clausius got this a little differently. He was before statistical mechanics. He said, let's define temperature to have p squared over m being proportional to temperature. The exact constants of proportionality were unknown to him and continued to be unknown until Einstein began to figure out the value of Avogadro's number, the number of molecules in a mole of substance. Okay, but we have to do this thing. The sum from j equals 1 to m of the epsilon d qj times qj. I am working with a case, not this case, not this. I'm working with a case epsilon is p squared over 2m plus u. Summed over j. I guess I really shouldn't call this epsilon. I should call it h for the Hamiltonian, but you know what I'm doing. And so I have to deal with this term. That is, I'm thinking about n particles all held in a box by a potential u. And this term on the right-hand side then, which is balancing against the kinetic energy, is the sum over j qj d u of q d q.
So question.
Thank you.
Are there no interaction terms in the potential, or
we can put them in. We'll put them in a moment. Or maybe we won't put them in, I don't know. But this, I'm following now a calculation which will give us the perfect gas law, and then we can talk about corrections to the perfect gas law in a moment. In fact, people have used this line of argument to get such corrections. Now, I'm only going to outline the argument that is required. Oh. Let me draw a box. There's a box. Here's a distance L. Here's an area A of the wall. I'm going to be thinking about this wall for a moment. This du dq is the force from the wall, from the on the that the wall exerts on the jth particle. This force, or rather with a minus sign, it's the force. This force points in this direction and pushes the jth particle that way. There's an analogous force from this wall pushing the particles that way, and depends where the jth particle is, whether it is pushed not at all, or pushed that way, or pushed this way. The total amount of push is the pressure exerted by the wall, or rather, the push times the area is the pressure exerted by the wall, is the force exerted by the wall. So with only a little bit more argument, we get the contribution from this wall being the Q, value of the position at that wall, times the pressure, and I'll write pressure for P since we've done P's for too many things, times the area. And this is from the wall one. Wall one. We get a similar contribution from wall two. This pressure points this way from wall one, which we will take to be positive, and we get a contribution from wall two, which is pressure again times area two, pointing in the opposite way, minus sign. Q at two, Q at one, plus sign here. However, these things are just the same. Q at 2 minus Q at 1 is L. So what you end up with is a contribution, which is pressure times area times L from these two walls. Now, this is a respectable three-dimensional box. It has four other walls, and you end up with a contribution from each direction. So here I should have a sum over walls. And I end up with 3 times the pressure times the volume. And that's exactly where Clausius, van der Waals, other people wanted to get. They wanted 3 times the pressure times the volume to be equal to the total kinetic energy, 3nkT. And now we have the perfect Gauss law done by a kinetic argument. As Boltzmann and other people pointed out, you could fix up this argument to include some of the interactions among the particles. For example, imagine, instead of talking about interaction for a moment, imagine that I had a big piece of dirt in there which prevented the particles from entering that region. You would then not be surprised to find that the volume that you calculated here also required a calculation from there, and the volume excluded by the piece of dirt would be left out of this overall calculation. So you'd get this with the dirt. This is the volume excluded by the piece of dirt, and I have to, in order to get this result, convert the sum to an integral. The sum over J is an integral over positions, and then I have a volume integral, and this piece of dirt is left out of the volume integral, and that's how you get an excluded volume. Now, there's another kind of excluded volume which occurs because of the interaction between molecules. I've got a molecule here. I have another molecule here. If this radius is 2a, and the radius is a and the diameter is 2a, there's an excluded volume which is equal to 2a times pi r cubed over 3. There is pi times 2a cubed over 3 excluded volume for each particle. If there are n such particles, there's that much excluded volume, and that's the excluded volume excluded by interactions among the particles. So the first thing we talk about in the behavior of the interactions between particles is that we get an excluded volume in this relationship that that we have for now the imperfect gas, and the relationship becomes omega minus the number of particles in the system times some constant, I guess called B, times the pressure is NKT.
Question.
Yes, please.
Why is that volume that, I mean, P is 2A, 2 over
3? Okay, the volume of a sphere is pi r cubed over 3. So that's the 3 and that's the pi. If they cut the volume which is excluded, they can't come closer together than twice a diameter. Because they each have a size A, and 2A is the distance they can come together. So it's pi times 2A cubed over 3. Picture. Distance excluded. It's 2A.
Doesn't need a sphere.
Excuse me?
I mean, the volume of a sphere is
pi r cubed, 4 pi r cubed over 3. Thank you.
Yes.
Bad day. It's a bad day. But although I won't make it by myself today, you guys will get me through it. I was struggling to remember that. Maybe I had it in my notes. Let's see what I had in my notes. No. The notes said I should do it excluded volume. That's what they said. And any idiot knows it's 4 pi. Excuse me. Any person who has any head with them knows that it should be 4 pi r cubed over 3. So thank you for bringing me into the right place. Yes, please.
Why did you multiply by 10?
Excuse me?
Why did you multiply by capital N?
Because there are N molecules, and each one carves out a volume that the other guys can't enter. It's like having N pieces of dirt, but N pieces of dirt that are very small. Now, big things are different from little things, and the molecules are not pieces of dirt. And this is only an approximation, but this is a pretty decent approximation. There's another effect which van der Waals considered, and we're working our way up to van der Waals, but I had a different way of approaching that. The other effect is the average force exerted by the molecules on each other. And I remind you that we calculate the partition function as an integral over all phase space. Of e to the minus beta h. When we talked about independent particles, we have 2 pi mkt. Raised to the 3/2 power times the volume of the system for this z, and all that is raised to the nth power. But we have another effect that we have to worry about. This is not the whole answer. In addition to this, there's an interaction among the molecules. H contains, among other things, the sum over J less than K of an interaction between the molecules. Now, we have taken into account some portion of that interaction by talking about this excluded volume effect. However, there's another portion of the interaction. Molecules relatively far away from each other exert a force on one another. They are, this is in effect, an attractive force. They're pulling into one another, and that's why a drop of water sticks together if you put a drop of water on a clean table. There's an attractive interaction among the molecules. That comes from a term which we have not taken into account in the Hamiltonian, and we have to think about that term. That term that we have not taken into account is, of course, precisely this term. And so it's a sum over J less than K of V of QJ minus QK. Now, I cannot today, nor can I accurately on any day, calculate what the average of this thing is up in the exponent. Calculate that exactly, and you'll have an exact theory of liquids, and nobody has such a thing. However, I can argue in the following way, following van der Waals. These guys are separated by a large distance. When they're separated by a large distance, they're not much correlated. Maybe what I should do is say that instead of the sum over K, I have an integral over all possible positions of K times, no, not times N over V. Instead of the sum over K, I have an integral over all possible positions times, okay, now I should look at my notes. The sum. Let's put it in some place where it's more. If the particles are uncorrelated, the sum over K can be replaced by an integral over all positions. And to make that dimensionally correct, we put in a factor of n over the volume of the system, except that there shouldn't be any n. There's a 1 over the volume of the system. So instead of summing over all the possible positions of K, we sort of integrate over all of those possible positions. And the potential term that we then get is the integral dq of v of qj minus q. And we have a 1 over omega, 1 over the volume of the system. I will call this integral minus a. The reason I call it minus a, well, A was used for something else, but it's historically what is done, is that we're talking about an attractive portion of potential, so the minus sign gives us a positive A, and all we're interested in is roughly to say that this kind of thing exists. And if it exists, then what we do is put in a minus 1 over KT times that minus A there times a times 1 over the volume of the system. We have left the sum over J, which gives us a total number of particles in the system. And so we have, as a rough approximation, e to the minus beta times A with a plus sign, 1 over the volume of the system for this sum over K, and the number of particles for sum over j gives us an n over omega. For the sum over j becomes an integral over j times the density of particles, so it's n over omega. This is what comes out from calculating this average. And I'm a little concerned that I haven't done this quite as smoothly and nicely as I should have. On the other hand, I'm sure that you guys, and each one of you, fix up my argument to make it better. Yes, please.
The product of n and the constants.
Okay. I know what the n dependence is. This is up in the free energy. The free energy.
I mean the constant 2 pi m kT.
Thank you. Everything in the partition function, or the logarithm of the partition function, has to be proportional to n because it's all extensive. And then what we do is we calculate the pressure as from the thermodynamic formula, that the pressure divided by kT is the derivative with respect to the volume of the logarithm of the partition function. And when you go through that, you end up with a formula in which the pressure, let me look it up in the notes, pressure is decreased by the attractive interactions. Pressure by A times N over omega squared. Is equal to omega minus omega excluded. That's from the previous calculation. The two calculations don't exactly P times omega minus omega excluded is equal to nkt. And in fact, we can put this exactly where we want to put it because the calculation doesn't say how the excluded volume and the and the A factor work together. And the conventional approximation is to say that this is A times N squared over omega P omega. Okay, so we start from there. We start from which the guys who did the calculation did a much better job than I, but we start from a situation in which we have an expression for the pressure-volume relation of a gas.
A question?
Yes, please.
I'm not sure to understand the n over omega in the exponential.
Okay. Everything you should do for the partition function should be done in the exponential. Here we have a sum over j. We already did the sum over k on that board.
Yeah.
The sum over k gave us a result which is proportional to 1 over omega. Here we have a sum over j. You tell me I screwed up. I screwed up because, in fact, by summing over j, I should just simply sum over all the particles in the system, that I should not have that 1 over omega factor. That's what you're telling me. And I don't believe that either. N over omega. I want something extensive. I will get that right next time I come in. My apologies. One moment while I pause to see what happens. Maybe I can get it right. I integrate over Q. My basic trouble is right there. The sum over K goes over into an integral over positions times N over omega. What a stupid place for me to make an error. This is the correct formula now. Let me check it out. The sum over K, if we apply to nothing at all, is N. This integral gives us the volume of the system times N. That's the right result. Then, when we integrate over Q, okay, we're getting it right. We have the sum over QJ of this. QK is what we call this. The sum over QK of this. That's equal to the integral over Q from this times N over omega V of QJ minus Q. This integral, we get the QJ out by shifting the origin of integration. That integral is minus A times N over omega. Then we go back and work here. And we say what we have left is the sum over J. For the sum over J, what we have left is the sum over J of minus A times N over omega. And that sum over J just gives us another factor of N, N squared over omega times A with a minus sign. And so N squared over omega with a minus sign to cancel that out. This result is now correct, and I check it by saying it should be extensive. Should be extensive, that it should grow as N when N and omega both grow uniformly, and in fact, this is proportional. This does grow as N when N and omega grow proportional to one another. That's then a correct result, and this then gives me the pressure divided by KT comes from differentiating this, and I will get an omega squared from differentiating that. There was an N squared. Okay, this stage it's right. Now I do take the, I get it right by saying the pressure divided by KT is d by d omega of log z. I have this stuff, this NKT comes directly from differentiating this omega, and then I have to differentiate this omega. Differentiating this omega gives me an I got a NKT over omega here. That's differentiating this omega. And then ended up with an N squared over omega squared there. The formula will come up again correctly in the notes. No, I'm not going to go back over it. Thank you for getting me straightened out. I believe I'm straightened out now, and we'll pile
Leo,
off.
One other question.
Okay, Amy says I'm not straightened out. She's much more polite than other people here.
I may be off on this. I thought that that second term would reduce the pressure, right? Because you've got an attractive force. So should that be a minus sign there? Yeah, I hate to do this to you.
But this just shows how professional physicists think about things. I wouldn't want to correct Amy for a moment. There's an omega downstairs. beta A 1 over omega. We had a minus sign because we defined A with a minus, so we have that minus sign. We have a 1 over omega there. When we differentiate, we get a minus sign. And that's the right answer.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. With a little help from my friends. Now, let's go on to HDMI. Oh, hi. Okay, then I got to do my thing. My thing here. I lost sight of this. There is the cursor. Do I have a picture up there? Not yet.
You're good on the back wall, though.
We should just all face backwards.
That's good on the front.
Good, thank you. Okay. Lights. Lights on, lights low. Okay, we're talking about phase transitions. This picture shows you the different phases of water. There's water vapor up in the air, there's liquid water down here, there's ice. Those are three different phases with qualitatively different properties, and we're going to talk about qualitative different properties of different phases of matter. Here's a phase diagram for water. You have on this axis, you have the temperature, and on this axis, you have the pressure. Here, you have at high temperatures and relatively low pressures, you have vapor. Here, you have liquid. Here, you have a line of first-order phase transitions, a line of jumps between the liquid and vapor. Those jumps occur exactly when one boils water. At higher values of the temperature and pressure, you can go around the phase transition line. Water, vapor, and liquid water are qualitatively similar, so you can go around the phase transition by going around this continuous phase transition point. There are various solid phases of water, various phases of ice up here, which I'm not going to be talking much about. Ehrenfest, who worked in the Netherlands mostly, defined first order phase transition as something with a continuous jump. What we need in order to describe a first order phase transition is what is called an order parameter. That is some quantity which does undergo a discontinuous jump. In the liquid gas phase transition, the order parameter is the density, which jumps discontinuously. In, for example, the ferromagnetic transition, the order parameter is the alignment of the spins, which occurs in the ferromagnetic phase, the magnetic phase called ferromagnetic, but doesn't occur in the non-magnetic phase called paramagnetic. Here, then, are pictures of liquid water and ice showing you what you all know and will know better by the end of this winter, that there are different phases of water. Okay, now we're caught up to van der Waals. In 1870-ish, 1869, in fact, Thomas Andrews, a British experimentalist, measured the phase diagram of carbon dioxide. What's up there is the phase diagram of water, roughly speaking, but this is what I could find on the internet. carbon dioxide is qualitatively similar. In this picture, which has volume and pressure, there's a liquid region. I've been doing this backwards for ages and ages and ages. Okay. In any case, in this picture, there is a region of these lines show the lines of a constant temperature on this pressure volume plot. There are several different kinds of lines. And at high temperatures, you just go continuously through a situation of large volume, which is the vapor, through a situation of smaller volume, which is a liquid. At low temperatures, there's a jump as you go along between liquid and vapor. Away from the jump, everything changes smoothly and continuously, discontinuous jump, and then you can, then again, when you get into the vapor region, you're doing things continuously. As the temperature is increased, the size of the jump gets smaller and smaller and smaller until at what is called a critical temperature, the size of the jump goes to zero, and we have what is called a critical point. We'll be fussing a lot with critical points, but mostly in later on in the week. Van der Waals wrote an equation, which I developed for you with a lot of help from you guys. And the equation has the form indicated here. This equation then says that, as Amy pointed out, that the pressure is decreased by a term in which we have something proportional to the pressure is decreased by a term in which we have something proportional to the number of particles. That is the excluded volume term, the other way around. The pressure, this is V minus excluded volume. You put this in the denominator, that pushes the pressure up. The pressure is increased by this V minus excluded volume term. The pressure is decreased by this attractive force term, and the law looks like this. If you notice that N over V appears here, if you divide this equation by N, this is a cubic equation in N over V, and these lines plotted look like cubics. I'm not sure you can see it. Can you see the lines?
Yep.
Okay, you can't see them on this one. I hope the next one's better. This is the excluded volume effect that we talked about before. Calculation. Okay. Lines of, my apologies. Worked on another, works with another projector. Things change when you go from different projectors. But let me show you what these guys were talking about by using the blackboard.
You can see the lines.
You can see the lines on this? Yes. I'm just too close to them. You see the lines here?
Yeah. And
okay.
Then back here, they're great.
Fine. It's wonderful. I'm too close. This is something that can't happen. This has the pressure increasing as we increase the volume. That's an instability in the equation. Maxwell pointed out that the van der Waals equations have this mechanical instability. And then Maxwell used thermodynamics to, in fact, eliminate the instabilities in the van der Waals analysis. And he did that by drawing lines of first-order phase transitions. I remind you that this van der Waals picture has in it continuous behavior and no jump like a first-order phase transition. The trouble with the van der Waals picture is that these lines showed unstable region, and van der Waals didn't quite know what to do with that unstable region. Maxwell, however, knew what to do with the unstable region. First, he marked it out, and then he drew lines which were the jumps of the first order phase transition covering the unstable region. There, those jumps, this jump, this jump, this jump, this one that goes to zero at the critical point, and then you have no more jump for pressures above that. So this is something that you've mostly seen before. This is a cartoon pressure versus volume diagram for water or carbon dioxide. This shows the different phases of the system and how they're related to one another. You can understand the relation then by using van der Waals equation, which is cubic in structure, plus adding Maxwell's analysis, putting in the discontinuous jumps representing mechanical and thermodynamic stability. A little later, Pierre Curie and Pierre Weiss used a very similar argument to the arguments that van der Waals used to derive his equations, to derive the properties of the paramagnetic to ferromagnetic transition. A bunch of people after that did all kinds of calculations which showed what happened in different phase transitions. All of these transitions are described, all of these calculations are described as mean field theory. That is, we leave out correlations. We do things like this, saying that the sum over all possible positions of the particles is simply an average, not over the actual positions, not over the correlations among the different particles, but simply an average over uncorrelated stuff. And then all of these guys get sort of mean field theory theories which describe all kinds of different phase transitions. Here's the phase diagram for the magnetic system. This is the simplest one. This is the one we're going to be talking about. On this axis is plotted temperature. That's like the one over the coupling in the Isaac model. And this axis has magnetic field. That's like H in the Isaac model. At low temperatures, there's a jump at zero magnetic field between states in which the magnetization points that way and the magnetization points that way. There's a jump of discontinuity in the magnetization right here. The jump is biggest at low temperatures, gets smaller and smaller as the temperature goes up, and the jump goes to zero as at the critical temperature, at a critical temperature. For example, iron has a critical temperature at about 600 degrees Kelvin. The jump, and again, I'm probably too close to read things, the jump goes as the temperature, critical temperature minus the temperature to an index which is called beta, which I can hardly read, but I suspect you can read. The fact that this jump goes to zero here as a power of Tc minus T is something we just talked about a moment ago, this power being something that you measure by doing things like the things that came out of the virial theorem. Beta in the van der Waals theory, as we will see in a moment, is equal to 1/2. That's not exactly what occurs in nature, but that's another story, and a story which I'm going to be going through. Okay, here's more of the magnetic phase diagram. Magnetization is here, not magnetic field. This is magnetization as a function of 1 over the temperature. This is like the average value of sigma in the Ising model, and this is like the coupling one in the Ising model. In this portion, this picture has a critical point right there. There is a jump at low temperatures, that is, high values of Tc over T, between states of high magnetization and states of low magnetization, jump. That jump is accomplished as you change magnetic field, going from high magnetic field to positive magnetic field to negative magnetic field. If you're working now at higher temperatures and vary the magnetic field, you don't get such a jump, you simply get a continuous behavior. This is almost exactly like the liquid gas case. It's just the variables have been changed. It's simpler to think about the magnetic variables than it is to think about the liquid gas variables. These lines drawn here are the magnetization as a function of magnetic field. If the quantity I called H is going to be negative, you get a negative magnetization, which increases as the which the magnitude of the magnetization increases as the temperature goes down. This is the same qualitative behavior. At zero magnetic field, you go along at zero magnetization, and then you have to make some choice between which side of this, whether you're on this line or this line, because this region through here is, as Maxwell pointed out, unstable. At positive magnetic fields, the magnetization increases as the temperature decreases. So that's what we have for a phase diagram. It's moderately familiar to many of you, and I'm going to talk for a second about the comparison between the two systems. This is, on this side, fluids, and on this side, magnets. The order parameter in the fluid is the density minus the critical density, and the magnet is the magnetization. It is varied by changing, for example, the pressure in the fluid case and the magnetic field in the magnetic case. The other thermodynamic variable, which determines where you are on the phase diagram, whether you're in a region in which there's a jump or not, is temperature in both cases. Interesting quantity to look at in the fluid case is the compressibility. That compressibility, for example, goes to infinity at the critical point. The thing becomes very easily compressed. The compressibility is the derivative of the volume with respect to pressure. The analogous quantity, which is the magnetic susceptibility, the derivative of the magnetization with respect to magnetic field, also goes to infinity at the critical point. There's a connection in which boiling in the liquid gas phase transition is the jump discontinuity in the magnetization. This connection was made in detail by Pierre Curie and by Weiss. Much later, Li and Yang, physicists who are still alive, these guys are early 20th century, Li and Yang suggested that the similarity could be extended much further. Okay, we're going to talk about the magnetic case by looking at the Ising model, which you already know all about, and looking at the free energy that comes in the Ising model. That free energy and the magnetization will depend on a coupling K and a magnetic field H. Even when H equals zero, if K is greater than the critical value, the spins line up and the magnetization chooses to be non-zero. We're going to focus on Ising models, and we're going to be talking about mean field theory in the context of the Ising model. First, I have to tell you, as I've told you several times in this course, how one deals with a single spin. You know that, but I'm just going to say it nonetheless. You have a value, spin is plus or minus one. You use a Hamiltonian, which is proportional to the magnetic field, which is then going to be equal to in which you define a dimensionless variable proportional to the magnetic field, and then you discover that the magnetization that comes out is proportional to the hyperbolic tangent of the magnetic field. Next, we do many spins, and I better grab a blackboard for this purpose. I think I should do this on the blackboard for a second. So, I have gone sort of fast through the qualitative material. I'm about to do a calculation of mean field theory. Are there questions or comments? Nine, 10. We start from the average magnetization is the hyperbolic tangent of the magnetic field, which arose when we had a Hamiltonian, which was H times sigma. Sigma has values plus or minus 1. Now we have a Hamiltonian, which is a sum over sides of magnetic field times sigma at the site J, plus a sum over nearest neighbor sites, that's what this bracket means, of sigma J times sigma K times a couple, capital K. Here we can think of an effective Hamiltonian. That's the Hamiltonian seen by this spin, sigma J. It sees, first of all, a magnetic field. And then it sees the spins with S nearest neighbor to J, to K nearest neighbor to J, sigma K. Of course, there's a lattice. I'll draw it in two dimensions. And here's our friendly J, and there's a K who's the nearest neighbor to it. Mean field theory is the approximate theory we use to describe this first-order phase transition. This sort of approximate theory has been used for 1870, 140 years, to describe phase transitions. You had a lecture on Feynman diagrams. The lecture probably mentioned the one-loop order. If it didn't, I just did. I have to tell you a story about that. The lecture probably mentioned the one-loop order. This mean field theory is the approximation that you use at the one-loop order. And what you do is you say that the spin at R, spin at J, H at J, is given by exactly the same structure as we have here, except that you replace this magnetic field by this sort of effective field that is applied to the spin at J. And that effective field is Hj plus K times the sum over K nearest neighbor to J, sigma J. And you do one more thing, which is crucial. You don't write the actual sigma j there, you write the average sigma j.
Should be j.
Thank you. With a little help from our friends. This is then the mean field theory approximation for the Ising model. It is exactly the same physical content as is used in 100 other theories, including this tadpole diagram. I cannot resist. I simply cannot resist now that I've mentioned this. Feynman invented Feynman diagrams. Well, you might expect that. Schwinger did not invent Feynman diagrams, and they were great rivals. Schwinger, as I said, was the big shot at my institution when I was a student. Because Feynman invented Feynman diagrams never appeared at my institution, Harvard, during the entire time I was a graduate student. Feynman diagrams could have existed in a different universe for all I learned as a graduate student. However, I grew up and stopped being a graduate student, and I was being sent out into the world. One of the postdocs came around and took me off into a corner and said, you know, in the rest of the world, people use Feynman diagrams, and this is what they are. Okay, but let's get back to work. What we want to do is solve this equation. In fact, you've already seen the solution to this equation. The picture, the diagrams that I put up for the magnetic field theory, or the magnetic field phase transition, were in fact diagrams drawn from this equation. I'm going to simplify the equation because I'm going to, first I will look at the limits and then I will simplify the equation. First, let me look at strong coupling, k goes to infinity. I'm going to have to guess something now, and I will guess that the magnetization is positive. Remember last time I talked about self-consistent theories? Well, in this particular case, the self-consistent thing is that you assume that you have one sign or the other of the magnetization. I'm going to assume large K and magnetization positive. Then the hyperbolic tangent, this hyperbolic tangent, is approximately equal to 1. And the hyperbolic tangent for large values of x is 1 minus e to the minus 2x, factor of 2 there. So the equation looks like the magnetization at point j is equal to 1 minus a correction, which is e to the minus k, sum over small k nearest neighbor to j, sigma sub k, and minus 2h at j. The only thing you really have to think about is this one here. The magnetization gets strongly lined up and is approximately equal to 1 if the coupling k goes to infinity. The opposite limit, which we will talk about a lot, is also the limit k goes to 0 and h goes to 0 and the magnetization being small. We might try to describe that by taking the limit of small values of x in the hyperbolic tangent. The hyperbolic tangent for small values of x is first x and next minus 1 cubed, one-third x cubed. The equation then for small values of the coupling, small values of the field, small values of the magnetization is that sigma j is equal to.
I made it. The effective H. Don't we need a sum over all H?
Go back. This is. I start here by saying let's sum over all H with an H sub J times the sigma J. I then ask, what does this guy see? This guy is a particular guy. Here, J is equal to 275, which is actually the point at 11.6. So it's a particular guy. That's the point I'm making. So we're going to look at the things that are important for the Hamiltonian of this particular guy. All the other values of H do not matter directly. It's only this guy. All of the values of all of the other spins don't matter. It's only the ones that are nearest neighbor to this one. So we have an effective Hamiltonian here and an effective field. Again, I have not done a great job because there are two H's. The effective Hamiltonian is this whole blessed thing. The effective field is the thing that multiplies the sigma J. And the effective field is what we put inside the hyperbolic tangent. But that's a crucial question, so I'm glad you asked it. So now we go back and we're calculating for, I'm glad some other people do like I do. I get stuck on some point and then I have to work at it for a few minutes before I understand what my problem is even. So, yes, it was good to come back to things. We're going to do this, and then we say sigma j is hj plus the coupling times the sum over k nearest neighbor to j times the average of sigma k minus one-third times some term cubed. We'll do the term cubed after a bit. Now I want to think for a moment about what that means. And thinking about what that means, I'm going to imagine that H is independent of position, that we just have a magnetization, which is independent of position, because H is independent of position. And then I have K times the magnetization. And I will have Z, which is the number of nearest neighbors to any given point. For example, the two-dimensional Isaac model. Z is 1, 2, 3, 4. In the three-dimensional case, Z is 6. And we can solve that. This is supposed to be a solution for small k and small h. We can solve that equation in which we have h over 1 minus k. Now we are in business to understand something. As k gets larger, this magnetization gets larger for fixed values of h. In fact, there appears to be a difficulty at kz equals 1. That difficulty is that the magnetization seems to blow up for fixed h at kz equals 1. This is what is called the critical point. and is a region in which interesting things are happening. In fact, I don't have the diagram up anymore, but you remember you had a picture that looked roughly like this, with jumps across here and no jump across here, and that this region here is the region KZ approximately equal to 1, H small, sigma small. We're of course interested in K is coupling called minus J divided by T times Z. There's a Boltzmann constant. We're interested in temperature equal to the critical temperature, and in fact, this equation with an equality sign defines the critical temperature. K is a coupling between neighboring spins. That coupling is a minus J with positive J divided by KT. J is a ferromagnetic coupling, a coupling trying to line up the spins, and that makes J negative so that J, K is positive. We are then about to analyze the case KZ small, H small, sigma small. This is a region in which something funny happens to the solution of the mean field theory equations. We will then use this mean field theory equation and try to figure out what use the mean field theory equation up there, and then try to figure out what that funny thing means and what it says about phase transition. This all starts from van der Waals. Van der Waals is an example of a mean field theory equation like this. In fact, we will find that when we expand our equation around the critical point, when we expand around these values, we will get a cubic equation for the magnetization, an equation which has exactly the same structure as the cubic van der Waals equation and has exactly the same, has essentially the same physics in it. But that's for next time. Next time we will do mean field theory, and then we'll start out arguing that mean field theory doesn't work tremendously well in the neighborhood of this critical point, and that one has to do better, and doing better will take us into things which are interesting for modern everyday physics.